We're joined today by Professor Ian Plimer, who's a prominent Australian geologist, a former professor of mining geology at the University of Adelaide, an emeritus professor of earth sciences at the University of Melbourne. He earned a Bachelor of Science with honours in the mining engineering at the University of New South Wales and holds a PhD in geology at Macquarie University. Professor Plimer, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
It's an honour. Now, we have a range of different topics we want to discuss today, but mainly on the topic of climate change. But before we get into that, for the sake of the audience, would you give us a little bit of background on your experience, your history, and why it is that you're speaking so passionately on this topic?
Well, I've always had an interest in the way the planet worked. I've been collecting rocks since I was about 4 years old, a great love of bushwalking, which fits in very well with geology, and a great love of being outdoors and in the outback. And so from a very early age, I was interested in rocks, minerals and fossils. And it was a little bit later I realised that these actually are the lead-in to what ancient environments were like. And then in my scientific career, my interests have been in the role of fluids like water and gases interacting with rocks. And this process is a process which tells us about how water behaves, how carbon dioxide behaves, how the planet is constantly being changed. And these changes are due to major geological forces, but at the surface, these changes are due to climate change. And so geologists have been studying climate change for some 250 years. It's only climate scientists have recently appeared on the scene. They're mainly mathematicians. They're not polymaths. They don't have a big view of the planet. And the story that I was hearing was absolutely and demonstrably wrong. And that was that human forces were far, far greater than any natural forces. And that these human forces were driving a huge planetary process. And we use history to understand the present. We don't make too many predictions. We leave that to foolish people. But the past is telling us that what we're experiencing today is nothing unusual. And to be able to try to find out if humans have been changing anything, such as climate on the surface of the Earth, is very, very difficult to do. We, unlike the modellers, we use evidence. And science is married to evidence. We get our evidence in geology from observation, and we do it time and time and time again, and that's a process of validation. We get our evidence from experiment, so we make rocks in the laboratory and work out how they behave and how much, say, carbon dioxide or water will dissolve in them. And we get our evidence from a combination of geophysical, geological, chemical, and physical processes. We just don't look at one thing. So our evidence is based on experiment, it's based on observation, and it's based on measurement. And all of that is not in accord with the hypothesis that we're being fed, and that is that human activities lead to a global climate change. The evidence is not there. And as a scientist, I've always been fascinated with evidence. I've always been interested in communicating to students. I've probably taught 10,000 students in my life. And I've always found it wise to tell the truth because then you never have to remember what you said. So I'm regarded as controversial because I use facts and I speak the truth. Well, if that's the case,
can you imagine?
So absolutely shocking.
Well, but we certainly appreciate people that are controversial for telling the truth here at Z Media. I can assure you of that. I want to ask, because this is, I want to look at the history of the climate change narrative. It wasn't that long ago that we were facing the deathly threat of an ice age. And then, you know, it was global warming all of a sudden because the ice age wasn't quite working out for them, it seems, with their narrative. And now we're using the term climate change and more than and anything being told that man is the problem of this climate change. So talk us through the history of how climate change, that term came about, and how it's actually being used as a propaganda tool, or so it seems.
Well, climates have always changed. And we've had global climates change since the beginning of time, which was 4,567 million years ago on planet Earth. And our climates change when we pull apart continents and stitch them back together again. Our climates change when we have a bad address in the galaxy, and that's every 143 million years, and that's when we endure an ice age. Our climates change when we get a little bit further or closer to the sun and the eon cycles of 100,000, 40,000 and 20,000 years. Our climates change when the solar cycles kick in, and this is when we emit more or less energy from the sun, and we go through grand solar minima and grand solar maximum and multiples and variables on an 11-year cycle, roughly 11 years. Our climates change on a 60-year ocean cycle, and our climates change every 18.6 years when the lunar tidal forces push warm water into the Arctic. And these are the times when the Northwest Passage is open. So it's for about 100 years, we've been aware that we have cycles of climate. And we were entering one of these cycles in the 1970s when the sun was not as active as previously and people were genuinely frightened that there was going to be an ice age. We were in a period of cooling. But since we've been measuring temperature in the 1850s, we've had three periods of warming and two of cooling and one period of stasis. So it was that period of cooling that got people concerned. Are we having a minor cooling or are we going into a massive ice age? The same people, some 15 years later, were telling us, because we started to come out of that cooling cycle, oh, we're going to fry and die and we're going to die from all this heat. Well, we were not told that most deaths from climate are in cold times. This is when we have starvation. This is when we have disease. This is when people die. And in warm times, we get an expansion of empires. We get longevity. We get better health. We get better food. So warmer times are good for humans, but we started to come into another slight warming phase. And I'm not talking about 10 degrees Celsius change. I'm talking about half degree change. And people then started to say, oh, we're coming into a warming phase, but this is the catch. There was money there. There was a follow the money syndrome that appeared in science, and people started to chase money to do research on warming. And the best way to get that money was to find someone to blame. And the best people to blame are we wealthy Westerners. So it arose out of people not understanding and not having enough data on climate cycles. We've got a lot more information now. People then chasing research funds, and there's massive competition for research funds around the world. So if you can get an angle where you frighten people witless, there will be money. So this is not an issue of climate. It's not an issue of the environment. It's an issue of money. And the mathematical modellers come up with scary scenarios that in 100 years' time we're going to fry and die, whereas we natural scientists look back in time and say, well, we've seen these cycles before. We've seen them many times and there's nothing to worry about. And I'll give an example. We came out of the latest glaciation, which was part of a big ice age. We came out of the latest glaciation 14,400 years ago. Since then, the temperature has been warming. So if you want to ask someone, is the planet warming or cooling, you have to say, since when? Because since the end of the glaciation, it's been warming. Since the time of Jesus, it's been cooling. Since the time of the Vikings, it's been warming. Since the medieval times, it's been cooling. Since the peak of the Little Ice Age 300 years ago, it's been warming. So this is telling us we've got cycles. But if you just look at a small bracket of time, you can say, oh, we're doomed. We're going to fry and die. So associated with this chasing of money for research is an enormous amount of deceit and some very well-documented fraud to be able to keep the narrative going, to be able to keep eminently unemployable, embittered academics working on their hobby.
So in amongst some of this fraud, can you give us some examples perhaps in Australia? Because we've just passed a climate change bill and the state of South Australia says that we are in a climate emergency. They've declared a climate emergency.
Well, these are hysterical words. There is no climate emergency with a fraction of a degree Celsius temperature change, bearing in mind that in the last 12,000 years on planet Earth, we've had temperature changes of up to 10 degrees Celsius. So it's certainly no emergency. And the way you get that emergency is that you have a plot of temperature record over time. Now, if you cool the temperature record, or if you have a plot like that and you cool the ancient temperature record, you can see rising. And this is what's happened. This has happened right across Australia by the Bureau of Meteorology, and we pay them $1 million a day. And Jennifer Marahassi has written many, many pieces of work showing that the Bureau of Meteorology amend the old records to make it look cooler. Therefore, the long-term trend looks as if it's warming. There is a crisis. It's a crisis of honesty. It's a crisis of common sense. It's a crisis of failed public policy, but it's certainly not a climate crisis. Now, not only do we see that in Australia, we see it worldwide. The second thing is that the temperature record is incomplete. We have most temperatures measured in the US and in Europe. We don't measure much in the ocean. We don't measure much in underpopulated parts of the world. So we have a record that's not an even record of surface temperatures on planet Earth. Now, we've solved that by letting radio sonde balloons go up, measuring temperature all the way up. We've solved that by having two satellite systems looking down onto the Earth, measuring the three-dimensional temperature. And when you look at those measurements, then there isn't a great warming trend at all. It's when you look at the land-based measurements, which can be tampered with, or you can have urban encroachment on a rural measuring station, and the urban heat island effect actually heats the latest measurements. So the whole temperature record is corrupted. And if we're going to have trillion-dollar energy decisions based on corrupted science, then that shows we've had absolutely no due diligence whatsoever. This is not an issue of science. It's not an issue of politics. It's an issue of ideology, feeding your mates with money.
So we're saying there is actually a proven, there are proven records that the Australian government and governments around the world have manipulated the weather data, the temperature data.
Yeah. The best example of that is Rutherglen in northern Victoria. And Jennifer Marahassi goes into that in great detail. But we also see it for Darwin. We see it for Bourke. We see it for many, many places in Australia. The records have been changed. Now, this I find enormously annoying, because we had people on outback stations for 150 years, going out every 3 hours, measuring the temperature, measuring the humidity, measuring the wind direction, and putting this down as a paper record. All that effort, which was done for gratis, is just thrown out. So we have this wonderful temperature record of the continent of Australia, and it's not accepted. It's thrown out. So we are actually on very dangerous territory when you ignore data, when you throw out data, or when you change data. Now, the same thing happens with the carbon dioxide record taken on a active volcano in Hawaii that's actually leaching out carbon dioxide. And occasionally in the lowlands on that island, we get carbon dioxide coming out of automobiles as hot carbon dioxide, and it rises. Almost all the measurements in this Mauna Loa measuring station are rejected. So what is the basis for rejecting them? What is the basis for accepting them? And as a scientist, I ask the questions, when was the measurement done? How was it done? Who did it? What were the corrections? What measurements were thrown out? And what measurements were accepted and why? Now, that hasn't happened with the carbon dioxide record, and that hasn't happened with the temperature record. But we know from other proxies that what we're being told is the exact inverse of what we know. For example, we have some 20 drill holes into Greenland and Antarctic ice. Now, that ice forms from snow falling down and collecting little bits of air and getting compressed into ice and covered with more and more snow. So if you drill a hole through the ice, you'll get some ancient snow. And from that ancient snow, we can work out with chemical fingerprints what the air temperature was, and we can work out what the age of the snow is, and we can work out how much carbon dioxide was in the air then. And what we find is that when we get a natural warming event, and we have many, many of these to work with, when we've had a natural warming event, 650 to 6,000 years later, we get a natural increase in carbon dioxide. Now, that's the exact opposite of what we're being told. We're being told that if we increase atmospheric carbon dioxide, we then get an increase in temperature. It's the opposite. we increase temperature and we get an increase in carbon dioxide. Now, that we know from ice core drilling, and that we know from Henry's law of chemistry, which has only been around for 200 years. So we're in the position now where you can say anything to the media because they are basically stenographers for the Greens. You can say anything to school children or adults because very, very few people understand or know the basics of science. And this is the end result of dumbing down of the education system for 60 years. We're now reaping the rewards of having trillion-dollar decisions being made that are going to put this country into gross poverty.
I want to talk about some of those consequences in a moment. But before we move on, Professor Plimer, what evidence do we actually have? I know you're saying this has been recorded, and forgive me, I don't remember the name of the individual you supplied who's written about it. But how do we know for certain that these temperature records have been amended?
Oh, well, Jennifer Marahashi has actually gone to the original records, has communicated with the Bureau of Meteorology. Graham Lloyd, the environmental writer for The Australian, did the same thing. So it's been validated. It's very, very clear. And once Graham Lloyd got to a certain point, then the Bureau of Meteorology wouldn't talk to him again. They'd been caught out. So we've got exceptionally good records of the changing of our long-term temperature record in Australia. We do actually have cycles which we can measure, and we can measure these cycles on river flows. We can measure these cycles on rainfall, just the same as we can measure cycles in the past. So we know that, for example, in Roman times, it was much warmer. How do we know this? Well, we know it from their salt harvests. We know it from where they grew olives. We know that they grew wine grapes in northern Yorkshire. It was warmer. They were scantily clad as a result. We know that in the Dark Ages, following that, starting at about 535 AD, we had the very, very cold periods of time. We know that from crop harvests. We know that from mortality rates. We know it from the onset of the plague, which came in and hit very weakened populations. We know, again, it warmed again in about 900 to 1300 AD. And that we know from church records. We know it from harvest records. We know it from longevity. We know it from agriculture, where we had so much successful agriculture that we were able to build the great churches and monasteries and cathedrals. We know it from Greenland, where Eric the Red said, come to Greenland, bring your cattle here, bring your sheep here. We grow wheat and barley in Greenland. And they dug graves. None of those things you could do today. So we know from proxies that we've had warming and cooling. We know that when we went into the little ice age in 1303, that the Gulf of Bosnia between Finland and Sweden froze. From shipping records, we can see that. We know that during the little ice age, it was incredibly cold when the sun was not very active. We're able to measure activity of the sun going right back that far. And every time the sun wasn't very active, we had these great temperature minimum, the last of which was a Maunder minimum. During this Maunder minimum 300 years ago, people were barbecuing oxen on the Thames, were skating on the canals in Holland. The great Dutch masters painted the hoarfrosts. So we've got a lot of proxies to say that temperature rises and falls. And we have a continuous temperature record in central England from about 1650, but we've got a continuous global temperature record from thermometers from about 1850. So the past is telling us what's happened. And if you change the past, you are fraudulent.
Well, that's fascinating, Professor Plimer. And the reason why I think that this conversation right now is so crucial is because of the fact that we can see how this is being used as an agenda, but it seems to be really ramping up, and it's ramping up all over the world. I want to point the viewers to one of your articles in The Spectator Australia. This is an article that's titled "Australia is Already at Net Zero." There are a number of very, very interesting things that you have written here, but I want to start with this this thing that we keep being told, that we have to achieve net zero, and we'll go into the fact that we're already at net zero afterwards. But what they're talking about is drastically reducing CO2 emissions, and they're telling us that CO2 is somehow, first of all, caused by humans, negative for the environment and destroying the environment and causing climate change. But in fact, CO2 is essential for plant life, and we actually need it to survive, or at least for the agricultural industry to survive. Talk us through First and foremost, why are they trying to reduce carbon?
The most important point to take home with this interview is that no one has ever proven that human emissions of carbon dioxide drive global warming. It's never been done. For 20 years, I've been trying to get scientists to say, well, just give me half a dozen scientific papers that are validated, that prove human emissions drive global warming. It's never been done. So the whole concept is built on a fallacy. Now, if you could prove that human emissions of carbon dioxide drive global warming, you would have to also prove to me that the natural emissions, which are 97% of the total, don't drive global warming. So the whole concept is built on an assumption. It's not built on any facts. And I've, like many other scientists, been asking time and time and time again for these facts. Now, what I get is obfuscation. What I get is dismissal. People just say, well, you're wrong. But I don't get any evidence, and science is married to evidence. Carbon dioxide is the gas of life. We have many of our planets, asteroids, and this Earth have carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. We've had three atmospheres on planet Earth. The first was rich in ammonia and methane and carbon dioxide. The second was rich in carbon dioxide, and the third now is rich in oxygen. We have cycles of carbon dioxide and cycles of oxygen. We have been sequestering carbon dioxide into limey rocks, into sediments, and more later into coal and oil on this planet since day one. So carbon has been involved in cycles all the time. If we halved the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, all plants would die and we'd have no animals. If we doubled it, we would have a very, very slight warming. And we've seen in the past that every time the atmospheric carbon dioxide is slightly higher, we get massive vegetation growth. Now, we've had a slight increase in atmospheric carbon dioxide over the last 40 years. Whether that's due to the delay in the warming from the medieval warming or the warming from the Roman warming or the warming since the more than minimum 300 years ago, we don't know. But we've had a slight increase in atmospheric carbon dioxide. As a result, we've had a greening of the Sahara. As a result, we've had better crop productivity, partly due to more plant food in the air, but also due to genetically modified crops and better agriculture and better fertilizers. So carbon dioxide has always been good for the planet and continues to be good for the planet, and it's certainly not poisonous. I'm breathing in 0.04% carbon dioxide. I'm breathing out 4% because I'm metabolizing carbon-based food. I can be in a room full of people, it'll be 1,000 parts per million carbon dioxide, or 0.1%. I can be in a submarine, it's 0.7%. If I breathe out at 4% and I kiss someone, then they inhale 4% carbon dioxide. Doesn't kill them. It is the gas of life. But it's easy to demonize it because heavy industry emits carbon dioxide. Transport emits carbon dioxide. Agriculture emits carbon dioxide. You can focus on that trace gas. You couldn't possibly focus on the main greenhouse gas, which is water vapor, which can be up to 4% of the atmosphere. You can't focus on that because people just laugh at you. So this is a mechanism of attacking industry. It's got nothing to do with climate or the environment. It is basically an attack by some very strange loopy left people who want to deindustrialize society. And we have known for hundreds of years that carbon dioxide is the gas of life. We know from agricultural experiments, if we grow crops in a high carbon dioxide atmosphere, they give better yields. Horticulturists burn propane and pump in warm water vapor and carbon dioxide into a glasshouse. That gives better yields. So we've attacked the wrong gas.
You've said in your article here that the next target will be food producing farmers when talking about alternative forms of power, and we'll have a discussion around solar and other unreliable forms of energy in a moment as well. But it's interesting because now they're talking about all this climate smart agriculture, which is essentially another form of tracking and tracing of farmers. It also talks about, you know, apps that monitor their water usage and these sorts of things. But it really does look like tracking and tracing to me. And I wonder with all of these, when we're looking at unreliable energy sources, for example, wind and solar, we don't always have the sun shining. We don't always have a windy day, not to mention the hypocrisy around this. And maybe you can weigh in on this, Professor Plimer, because we're talking about a problem being pollution and mining and all of these sorts of things. But how much mining will we have to do, or how much pollution are we going to cause in the production of these batteries, for example, that are required for electric vehicles? Which we're saying are the only solution now. I mean, the hypocrisy is astounding here.
Well, you've raised a couple of topics. So we'll start with our poor farmers first.
Sure.
Farmers are being attacked. We now produce enough food in Australia for 80 million people, but we are suffering problems of food security. The latest attack has been on methane. Now, in Australia, we have heavy industry. We have that because we once had cheap energy and we built smelters close to the energy providers. That cheap energy and the metals that we produced, such as aluminium, zinc, lead, copper, that led to Australians each having a higher emission of carbon dioxide per capita. We are also a very big country. People drive inordinately large distances, which adds to it. People also fly large distances. So in Australia, we have larger per capita emissions than most other countries. However, we have huge areas of grasslands, rangelands, crops, forests, and 2.5 million square kilometres of continental shelf, all of which are absorbing carbon dioxide. And we have some 10 times our emissions absorbed into the soils, the water, the crops, the grasslands, rangelands and forests. So we are already at net zero. The second thing is our poor beef farmers are getting attacked all the time. And this is a very simple mass balance, which we know from chemistry. Grass will absorb a certain amount of carbon dioxide from the air to make it grow. Now, if we don't eat that grass, it'll decompose, and the carbon in the carbon dioxide atoms goes back into the atmosphere as methane and a little bit of carbon dioxide. That's a process where nothing's added, nothing's gained. But if we have cattle eat that grass, they can convert that grass into meat, into piddle, into farts, into dung, into skin, into horn. And we extract from that the leather that we use. We actually take the leather out of the system. So by growing cattle, you're actually reducing the amount of carbon dioxide that would go back into the atmosphere. So they're already doing their bit. They're already at net zero or below it. So we are being fed a lot of absolute total rubbish. Now, we have had this false idea that human emissions drive global warming. It's never been shown. We therefore want to reduce these emissions. So we have this brilliant scheme to build wind and solar power generation. To make wind and solar generators, we actually use more energy to make them than they'll ever produce in their working life. And we emit more carbon dioxide in making and maintaining them than they'll ever emit. So it's a process which is bonkers. But to make it worse, our wind turbines destroy about 25 hectares per turbine, plus we've got crisscrossing traction cables across the countryside, which sterilises it. We slice and dice birds and bats, and 40% of the epoxy that's used in the laminated blades is made of a chemical called bisphenol A. Now, bisphenol A is extraordinarily toxic. It's banned in many countries in the world. We cannot recycle those turbine blades. We lose about 2.5 grams of bisphenol A every year from a blade. We only need 1 gram of bisphenol A, and we've destroyed 10 million litres of water. Over the life of a turbine blade, We destroy half a trillion litres of water by contaminating it with this high toxin. So we cannot recycle these blades. No third world country any longer will take them. What do? We cut them up, put them in soils, and such that bisphenol A leaks out into the soil and the waterways. Now, the same argument is used for solar panels. These solar panels are made by slave labour in China. These are Uyghur made because they're far cheaper than having them made in Europe or in the US. These panels have got selenium and tellurium and lead in them, which help with the electrical properties of the panel, but they're extreme toxins. And some of that dissolves out all the time. These solar panels are built on agricultural land. It's prime agricultural land, it's generally flat. And we are contaminating that with selenium, tellurium, and lead. We cannot recycle these panels. These panels then get dumped, and again, we pollute the environment. So you cannot be supporting wind and solar for environmental grounds. It's just not possible. You cannot be supporting it for climate grounds because you emit more carbon dioxide than you save. So what is this all about? It's about a total new business that's set up such that we punters can be skinned alive by business people who set up wind and solar facilities. Now, they get massive subsidies for these facilities. And then they thought of the next scheme. Oh, let's have electric vehicles. We can subsidise those too, which is happening in California. Now, we tried electric vehicles in the 1830s. They failed. We tried them again in the early 1900s. They failed.
Why did they fail, Professor Plimer?
For the same reasons they fail today. They don't have the fuel range, and the load that you have to carry as a battery is enormous. Now, the only electric vehicles that have ever worked have been milk deliveries at nighttime in London, where these were lead acid batteries driving a vehicle, delivering milk such that there wasn't noise of vehicles starting and shutting down all through the night. But they failed. But now we have this great push to have electric vehicles. But what our electric vehicles lovers don't tell us is the point you touched on, and that is that we need to have a huge increase in mining of lithium, of copper, of graphite, of nickel, and of cobalt. And what they don't tell us is that this cobalt comes from Africa. 90% of the world's cobalt comes from the Congo. This cobalt is mined by children. These children are black. These children are slaves. That cobalt is sold to the Chinese. Those children working underground die of rock collapses. They die of cobalt poisoning. So if you are a great moralist wandering around in your electric vehicle, you have to be able to justify why you are supporting black child slavery in Africa. If you're a supporter of solar panels, you have to be able to argue why you are supporting Uyghur slavery in China. If you're a supporter of all renewables, you have to be able to argue why you are contaminating for a very long period of time huge areas of the country. So this has got nothing to do with the environment or climate. It's all about an elite who have the opportunity to extract huge amounts of money for millions of average people. And it's a reverse Robin Hood. This is a case of the poor paying the rich.
Absolutely.
Not a good scene.
Certainly not. And it's clear to us what's going on here, Professor Plimer. We can see it, and we can see through some of the propaganda in the media. But it's completely different to hear it from someone who's actually studied the science behind it, as you have. I want to talk to you about a couple of different, still on the same topic, but something that is, I believe, is related. There's a report called the Melbourne Experiment, and I've brought that up on the screen now for the viewers. And it talks about the benefits of lockdowns on the climate. And it says that what they found during the Melbourne Experiment, and this is referencing the lockdowns during the time of COVID-19, humans contribute to urban warmth through anthropogenic emissions of heat and to global warming and unhealthy air through emissions of air pollution from industry, transport, and space heating. COVID-19 lockdowns provided a unique opportunity to quantify these effects. And then they sort of talk about how in 2020, the lockdown period showed mean daily temperatures up 1 to 2 degrees Celsius cooler than for the baseline baseline period. So what I'm reading from this Melbourne experiment is that they're quite fond of lockdowns. And we know that even in New Delhi, they were talking about climate lockdowns as well being needed because of the levels of pollution. Is this something that this group of elites have planned for the future, Professor Plimer?
Well, there's a couple of things. We've had a couple of global experiments on emissions of carbon dioxide. The first was in the Second World War. We were in a period of cooling, yet we were emitting much more carbon dioxide due to military equipment. So how come? We should have been warming, but we're in a period of cooling. So that shows that the whole thesis is wrong. The second thing is we had the global financial crisis and later the COVID-19 crisis. And this is when we had a reduction of transport, a reduction of air travel, and a cranking back of industry. So there was less human carbon dioxide put into the atmosphere. What happened? Measurements show that the total amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, entering the atmosphere, didn't change. It's still going up and up and up and up. And that's suggesting that humans have very little, if any, influence on the amount of carbon dioxide that's really filling the atmosphere. This is probably a hangover from the peak of our of our interglacial some 4,000 years ago, or from Roman times, or from medieval times. So those experiments have been very useful. The second thing is that it is a very human characteristic to want to control someone. And the COVID-19 epidemic, and it certainly wasn't a pandemic, the COVID-19 epidemic was a mechanism whereby little powerless, pathetic people were able to, by regulation and by frightening everyone witless, were able to lock you down. In the case of China, weld your apartment door closed. So we had situations where people would say, oh, what a wonderful mechanism of controlling people. And this then has been extended. It is extended on the thinking that we might be able to control the amount of heating or air conditioning or consumer products or meat that people eat. So this has been the hint that totalitarianism is only one step away. You've only got to have a war or an epidemic or some sort of crisis, and immediately the solution is totalitarian. And that's what we're seeing. And I think we'll see that occurring. We've already seen the attempts at totalitarianism to restrict Dutch farmers. They have objected. We're seeing those hints in Australia. But it's a very natural and unfortunate human characteristic to want to control someone and exert power over them. And it's generally done by people who have no power, people who are weak, and people who have very little knowledge. And they just stick behind mandates and regulation. So we have to fight this. We cannot let people tell us what to eat. Now, I love eating insects, but once removed. So chicken meat, I mean, you feed your chickens insects and the chicken meat's terrific to eat. I'm a vegan, once removed. I eat beef. The cattle eat the grass, they're the vegans, and I eat the cattle. We have to fight this very hard. And one of the key things about those people wanting to control us is that they have no sense of humour. You have to take the piss all the time. These people cannot laugh at themselves, and they certainly cannot say, I've made a mistake. So we have to fight this. Otherwise, we're going to lose freedoms. This whole bandwagon started with making money for research, then making money for wind and solar, then making money from hydrogen or pumped hydro or electric vehicles. Now, controlling people and making money out of that control. We have to fight this. We have the numbers, and it's this sort of communication, not the mainstream media, that are able to do it. The mainstream media are basically scribes for the Greens. These are basically scribes for government mandates, and we saw that in COVID. And we had a massive policy failure with COVID. We have a continuing massive policy failure with climate.
I want to ask you, Professor Plimer, and I'm so glad that you've spoken so openly on the fact that we are really on a trajectory towards totalitarianism. This is obvious, and we as people should not be as accepting as we saw some people were during the COVID-19 so-called pandemic. I agree with you, and most viewers would, that it was not a pandemic. I'll get back to this question, but I want to ask you about something that's incredibly controversial. Many Australians have been voicing concerns, but not just Australians, people from all over the world, particularly, you know, in Z Media's audience, we've got people from every country telling us that they're seeing that the skies are not the same. Senator Malcolm Roberts has opened an invitation to people to send him the evidence. But as people, you know, regular citizens in Australia, it's very difficult to obtain hard evidence that this is actually occurring. In your expertise and in your knowledge, are you aware of any weather modification that's happening around the world by these crazy climate scientists in order to mitigate the effects of climate change, say?
Well, I'm not aware of it, but I'm very much aware of their suggestions to do this, is to fill the atmosphere with various dusts that might reflect light and heat. I'm not aware this has been done, but we've had very small experiments in the past of seeding clouds with silver iodide to increase rainfall. This has partly got an agricultural reason, but it's also got a military reason. If you can have massive rainfall, you can bog down your enemy's tanks. So I'm yet to see the evidence, but nothing really does surprise me. And of course, we little people are despair. What can we do? What can we do? How can we beat the system? And I think we've got to look at the communist world to see the way some of the more spirited people in communist countries, such as in Poland or Czechoslovakia, actually beat totalitarianism. And I advise viewers to look up the book, The Good Soldier Shrek, written in 1923. It was written by a Czech author called Jaroslav Hašek. And Hašek did everything possible to avoid getting called up to fight in the First World War. And in one copy of Shrek I have, the translation makes Shrek look as if he's a total idiot, because everything he touches, he breaks or destroys it, but he never is able to get to the front. And he's totally and absolutely able to destroy his generals with his behaviour. The other translation I've got suggests that Shrek is actually quite conniving and very clever, and loosens lock washers on this. If he's given an order, he follows it absolutely to the letter. Now, most people don't know how to give written or verbal orders. If you follow it to the letter, you can totally stuff the system. So read Hašek's book. It was written in a bar. He used to pay for his meals and booze by writing a bit and putting it in a weekly newspaper. And the restaurant was called Ukalichi. I've been there. You can get some lovely dumplings and some pretty ordinary beer. That is the Bible for how to beat these systems. Just stuff them up from the inside. Just do a little bit here, a little bit there. If you get a mandate to do this, follow to the letter, because people won't have written that in perfect, correct, unequivocal English.
Well, I think I'd like to contribute my little bit to chip away here. And you know, this is an old project and an old website. I appreciate that you said you're not aware of this. So I thought I'd bring it up for the audience. This company is called WeatherTech, and on their website, they actually boast of weather modification activity that has occurred across the world. They were running the projects out of Jordan, it seems. It says worldwide success in harvesting atmospheric humidity. And if you go to the bottom here, it says Australia, Project Australia 1, Brisbane 2007, in conjunction with the Australian Rain Corporation. You know, they did another one here in Bundaberg, in the Bundaberg region in 2008 as well, where they had a substantial increase in the water available for the agricultural industry. So I think to say that weather modification doesn't occur, it would be, we can't say it doesn't, because clearly...
No, we can't. I'd like to see the evidence, and I'd like to see the long-term evidence.
Definitely.
And this has got the evidence over 50 years or so, and then tie that into the natural cycles we know. But as I said, anything's possible, and I'm at this gentle age where basically I don't trust any bureaucrat, I don't trust any government, I don't trust anyone mandating. I have enough knowledge, or the ability to gain knowledge, to make up my own mind. So get out of my life. And so I think anything is possible. And for a long while, people have been trying to modify the weather.
Well, here's the thing, Professor Plimer. If it's not happening, then it would be no problem to just come out and say, no, we're not doing this. But interestingly enough, and Z Media's lodging an FOI as we speak, because we did some digging into the Weather Modification Act here in Australia, or the Rainmaking Act, I should say, and it turns out that this is in legislation that they do this. And, you know, I suppose we could say maybe it's beneficial for the climate in some areas, maybe it's beneficial for the farmers, but give us the evidence. And then after some digging, it turns out it's not actually managed by the minister that we thought it was managed by. It's the Department of Jobs and Planning. They refuse to get back to you in writing. It's very interesting. But we're going to continue digging on this because I think we're onto something.
Well, good on you. Nothing surprises me. Nothing surprises me.
I want to talk about your book, Green Murder, over here, and I'm going to bring it up on the screen right now. This is a life sentence of net zero with no parole. And I want to talk about what actually happens when we decrease carbon dioxide to the levels that they're talking. They're talking about reducing our emissions by what I think is unachievable. And net zero sort of in their eyes, I mean, what they're suggesting is pay more tax to offset your carbon emissions, but really you're not really reducing your carbon emissions. But what actually happens if we do reduce our carbon emissions to this point? Because you're saying it's essential for plant life. It's essential for the agricultural industry. What happens next, Professor Plimer?
Well, no country's ever been able to demonstrate it can reduce carbon emissions unless you have a crisis like the global financial crisis or the COVID-19 epidemic. But we haven't achieved that. The proportion of fossil fuels that we are using now is no different from 100 years ago. We're just using more energy because we've got more people and more energy-intensive systems. So we've not been able to reduce emissions, and I doubt whether we can. But assume we can, then all we're doing is reducing the amount of food we produce. Now, if that's not bonkers, I don't know what is. So people making these suggestions and governments in power at that time will not be around to see the consequences. I think these people should be responsible for the consequences of the actions. And I think now we can see the financial consequences. Later, we'll see other serious consequences, such as employment and total exporting of industry, sovereignty risks, etc. I think we should make people responsible now. No one has ever shown that this gas of life drives global warming. Let's have the fight now before we go broke.
Absolutely. I have to agree with your statements. I've referenced the Paris Agreement of 2015 on more than one occasion. There is not one solution in there, from what I can see, tangible solution as to how we're going to combat this so-called catastrophe of climate change. And even in our climate change legislation in Australia, it references the Paris Agreement. Well, you go to read the Paris Agreement and there's nothing of substance there either. So it's clear to us that this is definitely a scam, like most of what the government tells us. Professor Plimer, I want to know from you, because a lot of people know that we need to be proactive about this, because we can see that the government will use this for control, particularly Australia's Pandemic Preparedness Plan talks about how future pandemics will be driven by climate change. So we need to be proactive on this topic and prove that it is a farce. What do people need to know? Where do they need to go for information, and how do they get involved with the cause?
I think what you need to know is to get away from the mainstream media. I think a lot of the media outlets like yours, a lot of the blog sites, websites have a lot of information. The reason I write books is to give people the weapons to go on attack. And I had an international bestseller, Heaven and Earth, 10 years ago, giving people all the missing science, the science that shows us that everything is wrong with what we're being told. This book, Green Murder, is to show that the Greens do not occupy the high moral ground. The Greens are fraudulent, they lie, and if when you're in doubt, follow the money. So I put these books out there with thousands of references such that people can do it. I do a huge amount of public speaking. I do quite a bit of media work. I've got a Sky TV with Rowan Dean tonight. I've got a public talk tomorrow night. I'll drive 500 kilometres each way to do that. I do this all the time. I do it because I'm concerned. I'm concerned about the future of my country. I'm concerned about the future that my kids and grandkids face in this country. I don't want to see them having a lower standard of living and lower quality of life than mine. I'm a baby boomer. We came from very frugal times. We had to get out of bed early. We had to work hard. And there was no entitlement. The successful people are those that bent their back. I want that to be inculcated in my children and grandchildren such that they too can have a good life in Australia, which as one who's travelled to more than 100 countries doing my geological work, we did win the lottery of life by living in this country. So I want to make this country a better place, but I can't do it myself. I can provide people with weapons, but armies are not comprised of one person. They're comprised of a very large number of people, and this has got to be fought like a guerrilla war. Every opportunity you discuss about climate change. Yesterday I had some of my books, Green Murder, delivered. The Courier and I were putting these in the garage when it was bucketing with rain, and I said, well, that's climate change. And he rolled his eyes and said, well, if you believe that bullshit, you need to have another drink. You've got to do that all the time. Every time you're at the supermarket, every time you're with friends. Now, you'll be cancelled. You won't get invited to certain dinner parties, but there, I don't want to go with those sort of people anyway. But you have to deal with what I think is one of the greatest issues that this nation has ever faced. This is an existential threat. Do we send ourselves broke? And if we do that, we have no jobs. We have no defence, we have no health care, we have no welfare, we have no education. And people have fought and died for this for hundreds of years, and we cannot lose what I think are the great threads of Western civilization that go through our society.
Absolutely, that was powerful, Professor Plimer, and I agree with you. And I think that the people watching this, certainly Z Media's audience, are an army of information warriors, I can assure you of that. They're very intelligent people who know to look other than the mainstream media for their information. So we certainly appreciate you coming on today. We appreciate your expertise. We'd love to have you back because I know that this is going to be a huge topic of discussion for the years to come. Professor Plimer, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Z Media is proud to announce our limited time partnership with Goldstackers, Australia's leading dealer of gold and silver bullion. In such uncertain times in the market, many are switching to lasting physical assets like gold and silver rather than depending on the crumbling financial system. Goldstackers is an Aussie partner you can trust. They have a huge range of available gold and silver at competitive prices, a friendly, experienced team on standby for all of your questions, are family-owned and have been specializing in precious metals for over 40 years. They're looking forward to helping anyone that has come through Z Media, so click the link in the description below or call 1300 618 363. Let them know you've come through us and secure your wealth today.